This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may your beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may your beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Right. So now it's time to answer some questions. Oh. How did you become a monk? Maybe I'll answer this one later on. Next question. Oh, okay. How can we realize animitta is observed in meditation? If it is observed, how can the meditation turns to deep levels afterwards? Okay, so they're asking a question about the deeper states of meditation, and yeah, I think, you know, it's wonderful if you're having these experiences of so the nimitta is like is basically the mind showing itself within the meditation. So it's like a reflection of the mind, and if the mind is in a wholesome state, it would what happens is like a bright light would appear in the mind. Yeah. And not many meditators experience this. So it's one of those deeper states that you know, sometimes people, I don't know, maybe it's because of their past karma or because they've been practicing for a long time, or maybe they just get lucky. They get these like deeper states, they start to arise within the mind. And the person is asking, how do you turn these into deeper levels of meditation? Well, basically, he has a quote from the masters. Ajahn Brahm would say, when you get to these levels in meditation, it's basically an automatic process. So the more, like this person is asking, how do you turn this into a deeper meditation? So what's happening there is this person is having some sort of craving to change something which is amazing in front of them into something deeper. So when you get to, you know, these deeper stages of meditation, you don't really have to do much. And actually, the less you do, the deeper it will go. So in a sense, if you want to just think about meditation in an overall sense, the more you do while you're meditating, the less further you will go. But the less you do, the more deeper you get. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Anything else? No? Okay. Oh, okay. These are deep questions. Okay, what is... Oh, no, I can't really answer that. Because what is your experience with jhanas? So basically, the Buddha protected the monks from letting other people know about their like deep attainments. So there's actual a rule that disallow a monk to talk about like the deep meditations or about psychic powers, the ability to like read minds and tell the future. So I cannot answer that question. Okay, how do you know if or when you have experienced jhana? I think you would know, because it's one of these experiences that you have never experienced before. It's otherworldly. It's difficult to describe, but it's something that... it's really hard to describe. Like you can talk about like near-death experiences, or when you have like an accident, or jumping out of a plane, you actually know that you're jumping out of a plane, you actually know that you've actually been in a car accident, or you actually know that you've had like a near-death experience. So I think if you do attain a jhana, you know that you've attained something. It's very, very, very obvious to the person who's experiencing that. But you may not know what it means. So that's when you go see like an experienced meditator and describe what you've went through, and they can tell you whether it is a jhana or not. Yeah. It's like I asked Ajahn Brahm, what is the experience like to become like to have the deep insights into the Dhamma, like becoming a stream enterer and things like that? What is it like? And he just put it simply, it's like getting hit across the face with a baseball bat. So you know when these things happen, they are very, very, very obvious. And you could say these are the things that like if you have these experiences, they leave no doubt in your mind. Yeah? So when you have no doubt in your mind, you don't really need to ask questions. Oh, have I experienced this, or am I enlightened, and things like that. If you do ask questions, then there's a good chance that those experiences are not real. Sorry to say, but sometimes they're not real. Yeah. Okay. Any questions, comments, complaints? Okay. I always find a point of discomfort when beginning trying to meditate. Lying and sitting is this just my restless mind finding a way out of the meditation and something that just requires patience and perseverance? Any tips, please? Ooh, very nice handwriting. Okay, yeah, so it's very nice handwriting. So at the beginning of the meditation, this person says that they're going through some sort of discomfort. It's interesting. It's just, what kind of discomfort is it? Is it discomfort of the mind, of the body? Okay, so yeah, sometimes it could be the restless mind, but I think the longer one meditates, one gets to a point where their body just feels comfortable in the position that they're sitting in. It's as if the body has reached to a level of relaxation where it can sit for long periods of time without feeling too much discomfort. I remember when I first started meditating, I couldn't even sit on the floor properly. So my legs were like up, like, you know. And then it would hurt after like 15 minutes. But then after a while, my legs started to become a little bit more flexible. And the pain just slowly disappears. And I think two things occur when the body starts to relax. The mind also relaxes, yeah? So I think, the journey of meditation, when there is like a gradual training, and the Buddha did talk about the body becoming like tranquil, like the body becoming relaxed. And that's after the initial stages that a meditator has to go through. So you get to this point where your body feels like relaxed, it feels supple, and it can sit down for many hours without too much pain. Even though the mind may be a little bit restless, but I think the mind would eventually catch up to the body. So yeah, there is a relationship with the body and the mind when it comes to meditation. Mm. Yeah, like they were asking, is it their restless mind creating this discomfort? And it is understood that sometimes when we meditate for long periods of time, we get bored. And we start to look for distractions within our own mind. So, like if I have a building project to do in the monastery, and I've started the meditation, my afternoon meditation, I'll be like, everything's going well. And then after a while, you get a little bit bored, you know, because you've been doing it for a long time and you're just not feeling it that day. So then your mind starts to find distractions. So for me, okay, I've got a building project going on, so I start thinking about the building project. This is what I've got to do, this is what I'm going to get, I've got to tell this person to do this and stuff like that. So in a sense, sometimes when we get bored, we go looking for things to distract our minds because we don't... why is it that we get bored? And one of the reasons why we get bored is we're not content with what's happening in the present moment. We aren't able to accept our minds for what it is. So we end up looking for stuff. And sometimes when you talk to people and they have like certain hindrances, like becoming sleepy or being restless or just having ill will, it's sometimes due to the fact that we're not happy where we are, so we go look for something else. Yeah. And just see it as a distraction. And then we just bring our mind, you know, back to the present moment and just learn how to be like content with whatever's happening now. Yeah. And just allow the process to develop itself. I mean, one of the monks, he would say like 90% of like a meditator's practice, he's talking about monks, it's just living in a monastery. Because all the causes and conditions are there for the mind to settle down. And even though you only have like a couple of days, you can only reach like a certain level of stillness and peace. But I think if you can get just a taste of what peace is, then the time that you spent here is worthwhile. I was just talking to somebody earlier and they were saying that even though when they're meditating, sometimes they don't really know what is going on, but they know that they're actually getting something beneficial from this practice. And I think that's an insight, really, that gives you the understanding that this meditation does have a benefit and it does work if you continue with the practice. Yeah. And it's a nice thing to, you know, this monk said 90% of the practice is just living in a monastery. And living in a monastery is not all about just meditation, but it's all the other things that you do in your everyday life, how you interact with people, how you treat yourself, yeah, how you talk, how you think. Everything comes together. It's sort of like, you know, the Buddhist teachings is more of a lifestyle than just meditation. It's more of a lifestyle than just being good. It's something that we incorporate into our everyday life, and each day we just try to do something to make an improvement in ourselves or to the people around us. And it's like and it needs patience. And then over the years you start to see your life improving, you're becoming a more happier person, and you know intuitively, you know, like deep down in your gut, that you're doing something good and that you're on the right path. Okay. Oops. Any questions? Come on. Don't be shy. Oh, there you go.
Well, I do have a question.
Yes. That's fine.
Waiting until something comes up.
Okay. However, nothing comes up.
Oh, okay. All right.
Just go for it.
Okay. Ashan.
Yeah.
Back in probably about 2003, mm-hmm. probably the same retreat, the Sister Ayama that you were on.
Really?
Good. Stack up against your own experience.
Yes.
I asked Sister Bayama about the belief, the knowing, the truth of rebirth.
Yes.
In the tradition of Buddhism. And I said, is it a leap of faith? Or is it a knowing? Is it something that you attain, you an insight and understanding of truth in your deep states of meditation?
Hmm.
So whether she was speaking of personal experience or generally, I don't know. So in my subsequent experience, I don't negate it, but I've never had anything which suggests to me that that is something that...
So you have doubts?
No, I don't know that I have. It's not a doubt. I just
Okay.
Although I don't negate it, I guess I'm still curious as to where does that come from? Where does that that ease that monastics say, you know, it's karma river, and it's so easy. And I can't, you know, I can't suggest that it's just a leap of faith with you guys. You know, it has to be.
We do talk about this subject amongst monks quite often, and I think some part of it is a leap of faith, actually, because we have faith in our teacher Ajahn Brahm, and he talks about it, and he says that yes, rebirth is actually a truth, and that one can actually realize it for themselves if their meditation gets deeper enough, so you can actually send your mind back to your previous lives. And then he also talks about research that's been done by a university professor. I don't remember the details, but I'm sure there's talks online about it. But I think all in all, you don't really know until you know. So it's more of like a belief, I would say, in most of us, because the truth is we don't really know until we actually know it. But we have that much faith in the Buddhist teachings and also in our teacher that we can be confident enough that his words are true. Yeah? And I think if one comes to an acceptance of the idea of rebirth and karma, one can look at life in a bigger picture and not be so caught up in death, really, because you know if sometimes we don't have this, you know, people who don't have a belief in, I'm not 100% sure, but like people you can make a big deal out of somebody dying, you know, and I don't know how the West treats it, but I come from a very traditional family. And just like being around like the, you know, Asian people, and who aren't Buddhist, but they put such an like importance on when somebody dies. So they have these like ceremonies and things like that. And thinking that having a big ceremony, having a lot of prayers would send this person to like a better place, and for myself as a Buddhist, we don't think things work that way. When we, like as a Buddhist, when we pass away, our next destination is basically determined on how on the karma that we've made in this life and in previous lives. Yeah, and it also, you know. How would you say, like, you know, if you believe in rebirth, you're not afraid of death as much as you can be, because you know that this is not your only life. You are going to move on. That's another benefit.
So I guess that's the question mark sometimes. Is it because we have, as human beings, a fear and a knowledge of death that we rely on that belief to stop that fear? Is it not enough for us to exist and then not?
Sorry, it's not.
Even if it doesn't make sense, is it not good enough for us to. Is it not okay for us to exist, have this life, and then to not?
You know, it's fine. Yes, that's fine. We are talking about like birth and we're talking about rebirth and like the benefits of having that belief can help you ease you into the dying process. But I have a friend who's a nurse, and he's surrounded by death all the time, and these people are not Buddhists. They don't believe in like rebirth, but they just believe in they're just like everyday Australians, you know, He told me that there's two types of attitudes that he experiences when somebody's dying. There's the one who fights death and who doesn't want to die, and the one who accepts it and the process that they're going through. So at the same time, you know, when it comes to dying, it's also our attitude towards it. And to be honest, you know, it's like, how many of us here are we really ready to die? we are, but if you look deeply, I think each and every one of us is a little bit scared of that process. Yeah, because the truth is, you don't really know what is going to happen. Yeah. But it's interesting, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is that good enough? Okay. Okay. How do we know when we are experiencing deep meditation? I think I answered this question before. How do we reach and sustain it? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That'll take you all the way. Yeah. Yeah. Just simple practice. That's all it is. And just being consistent, making it like a daily part of your life, I think, would be very helpful. So I think Ajahn Chah would say, you know, you come on retreat, you get all these deep meditations, and then when you leave the meditation center, you go and live your life, and then you sort of blow it. And then you don't really get anything from it, so then you come back and meditate again. And he said, yeah, you know, you can, some meditators do that, and they do get benefits, but it's not something which is lasting. So in, you know, this kind of tradition, we think more of the, you know, the long-term effects that the meditation practice has on us. So having a consistent practice, doing it every day, is much more important than thinking about how deep your practice is going. Yeah. Any questions, comments? Huh? Oh, how do you find time? Yeah, you guys are busy, aren't you? In the mornings, like, honestly, right? Because I hang out with my brother. He's about your. I think he's a little bit younger than you. He's got a wife. I hang out with my sister, and I spend time with my mum. Honestly, right? Human beings, we waste a lot of time. Is it true? Yeah. So just think about how you're spending your time. And then just put it like, what's 20 minutes, you know? What's 30 minutes? So you just put that time aside and just dedicate it to the meditation practice. Yeah. Because we do have a lot of time. I mean, we have our jobs, but we have the weekends, we have the afternoons. Yeah, we do actually have a lot of time. So just make some time and see how you go. Yeah. Okay. It appears that the accumulation of attachments is a natural part of life. Though the relationships we nurture and depend on and the structure of our society, career development, financial stability, etc. Can you speak to this and provide insight on how we can continue to be part of this world while being able to let go and maintain true inner peace? Yeah, it's kind of hard to say because I've been a monk for a long time, and we have the opportunity to be able to dedicate our life to the meditation practice, and you know, we have hours every day to sit and develop peaceful states of mind. But what I've learned over the years is is once you develop like a sense of peace within your mind, you can take that into your everyday duties. Yeah, sometimes you think, oh, you know, like you take for Ajahn Brahma for example, he's a well versed meditator, and he knows how to move in the world that he lives in a peaceful manner, and you could say his life is busier than some of us, and at the moment he's in England trying to build up awareness for the Nuns Monastery project, and I'm sure when he's coming back he's got a few other things to do and then he's off travelling again. So he does have a very busy life, but he can do these things with a sense of like inner peace. And I think I may be wrong, but if you can start like developing your meditation, that inner peace, that stability of the mind, that's something that stays with you. Yeah. And you can bring that out into the world. And when you're getting a little bit burnt out or you can always retreat and just like recharge those batteries. Because I think it is true, because, you know, this path is all about meditation, but it's also about insight as well. And insights is this, how would you describe it? Insight is having an understanding of the mind, having an understanding of your mind and being able to like create peaceful states. So in a sense, you can develop your mind to like, I think like a certain a level of peacefulness, but you don't lose it because you understand how to get there and what you did, understand how to get there. So I think, yes, it is possible to be able to you know, have relationships, have a career and things like this, and still be peaceful within this world. But first of all, we have to know how to find that peace. And also, on the journey of finding that peace, you develop your own wisdom and how you got there. So whenever you need to like go back to that place of stillness, it's very easy for you to get there. Yeah. Yeah, so yeah. And all, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, so, you know, as a monk, sometimes you might just lose it a little bit. But you calm down very quickly. yeah. Then you just chill. You don't learn how to hold grudges because they're like a killer to your happiness. Yeah. So you learn how to let these things go, and it's like living a peaceful life is not living a life where you don't think and become a vegetable. Living a peaceful life is also having the capabilities of functioning well and healthily in society. It's like I'm sitting down and I'm talking to you. This is not like a very peaceful activity, is it? Just talking, thinking. It can sort of like send your mind into a tailspin. But I don't know. I just do it like with an attitude of just being able to give and trying to bring a little bit of happiness into it, and also it's just the years of training that sort of like changed my mind in a certain way. And I'm able to just give it to you guys in the best possible way I can. And once it's done, it's done. I go back to my room and I don't really think about it. Sometimes I think, oh, what did I think of my talk? And that's sort of like the ego coming in, you know. You sort of like, yeah, I'm teaching now, and I want everybody to like my talk and things like that. But you know, after a while, that just gets less and less and less. Yes, it's nice to get good feedback, but at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, you know, because these things are just like another thing to occupy your mind. So after this, I just go back to my room and I just move on. I think living peacefully is having the ability to just move on from your day-to-day activities in a, you know, like in a fluid manner. You know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah, and then I don't know, life just becomes easier. You become a more happier person, and you become highly functional actually, because your mind is it's aware, you know, it knows what's happening around it, so it can act accordingly. But you know, it doesn't make you a more intelligent person. It doesn't make you more of a creative person. It just makes you more of a like somebody who's more aware and awake, I think, in the environment that they're staying in or living in. And also because is a practice of basically looking after yourself, protecting your own inner happiness, your own peace of mind. Yeah. You know, we have to, as human beings, we have to interact with other people. And some people's energies can just bring us down. And yeah, and you might think, how do you monks know this? You guys live in the monastery. Everything's like, everything's beautiful and harmonious. But the truth is, you know, we're monks, right? We're not arahats. So we have our problems and defilements, and we actually up against each other. So this is how we learn the Dhamma in the monastery. And it's sort of like, you know, the suffering in life, that's where you learn the Dhamma. So I can tell you that in a monastery, there's enough suffering for us to learn the Dhamma with. Yeah. So yeah, okay. Any questions, comments? No? Okay. Okay, how can we use worries and anxiety to strengthen our practice? What? Ooh. How can we make the most of these overwhelming feelings? Okay. Yes. Okay. So worries and anxieties. Okay. You asked the question, why do you like to worry? Yeah? Why are you anxious? Interesting. Is it because you like to worry? Or do you like to be anxious? Well, it's really hard to say because I don't really know what an anxious person really goes through, or what a person who worries too much really goes through. You can see a person just by their, you know, facial expression and their body language that they're an anxious person or a person that worries a lot, but you don't really know what is going on in their heads. So I think, so the meditation practice is all about getting your mind away from these worries. It's not all about, but to help you get your mind away from these worries and anxieties. And sometimes we can try different types of meditation objects. And I think walking meditation helps, because it takes our minds, it takes our minds away from our thoughts and into the body. So like the body is like, you can feel like physical sensations. Like, you know, when it's like, you know, when people do something physical, yeah? Like when you go for a run or when you play sports or when you're drilling a hole into a wall or something like that. Or when you're, you know, you can see like you may be anxious beforehand, but after you do some sort of like physical activity, your anxiety is not there. Yeah? Because you got something to basically take your mind away from your anxiety. It's pretty much a little bit of a distraction, but it works. So in the same way, when it comes to the meditation practice, we try to look for like a more obvious meditation object. And the one that you can do when you're sitting down is the body, like the body sweeping. And a lot of people actually like that because it takes their minds out of their heads and into their bodies. And when your mind is in your body, you're not worried about anything. You're not being anxious about anything as well. So using that, using your mindfulness to just scan your body when you're meditating, like feeling the sensations of what's happening in the feet and also, you know, in your back or in your, what's going on in your, on your head, the temperature of your body, the aches and pains as well. And those things help you take your mind away from your troubles. And also the walking meditation is also, I think, very helpful. Just being able to just find a place where you can just walk up and down and just being aware of the sensations that are happening in your body. Yeah. And the thing, so those things help. And the thing about, you know, people who worry too much or people who suffer from anxiety, I think this is like something that's been happening for ever since they were like young, and it's a habit that they've developed over the years, and it's something that sort of becomes a part of their personality. It's who they are. And yeah, you know, it's sort of like, I think you can start to see like the danger in having these states of mind. And that's the kind of word that you find quite often in the suttas, is like seeing the dangers in things. And when you see, like for example, like if you see like a poisonous snake, like just comes around in front of you, because you know it's dangerous, you step away from it, yeah? Or if you come across like a bushfire, you know not to touch it or try to do anything too stupid, otherwise you're going to end up hurting yourself. So the Buddha was using this word, seeing the danger in things, and he applied that to the mind. So I think if you can start to see the danger in anxiety and also in worries, you can start to learn how, you can, I don't know if it works, but it might help you, give you the you know, perspective to be able to try to step away from those anxieties and worries. And always coming back, like, what causes a person to be anxious, or what causes a person to worry? And sometimes, do we really need to be worrying about something? Or do we really need to be anxious about something? Because usually life sort of like works itself out. Maybe that's my lucky go happy kind of outlook on life, but life goes on. Something happens, it just goes on. And at the end of the day, you don't really need to worry or overthink about things that happen in life, I think. But that's just the way I sort of like look at things. Okay, hopefully that was good enough. Any more questions, comments? No? No, okay. Okay. I was just seeing if any thoughts come up about worrying and anxiety, but nothing's coming up, so I'll just move on. Any ideas, tricks, or anything to keep the crazy monkey mind after? Okay, I spoke to this person, yeah. After a family bereavement. I spoke to this person, so I don't know. I won't answer the question. Yes?
Could you please answer it, actually?
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. Have you asked her? I guess I can answer it. Okay, any ideas, tricks, or anything to keep a crazy monkey mind after a family bereavement? So hard to keep the mind in check. Yeah, I can answer this question. So, after many months, so basically a loved one passed away and the person's still suffering after many months. And I think, so sometimes we come to, when we come across Buddhism, we have the idea that the Buddha has a magical pill and he gives it to us, we take it and all our problems go away. Yeah? Let go, let go, let go, and then you won't have any problems. But sometimes life doesn't work that way. A lot of times life doesn't work that way. So what this person is talking about is how come he's like suffering over somebody's death, even after many months of that person passing away. And I think when you go back to the Buddhist teachings, it's quite obvious, is because the amount of craving and attachment that we had to that person. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, it's just human nature. When we love somebody, when we have a family, attachments happen naturally. And I always say, you know, the more you love somebody, the longer you love somebody for, the heavier the suffering that's going to be when that person upsets you or that person passes away. So it's like I think it's only natural if a person suffers for that duration of time. And I think one of the reasons why the Buddha pointed out that these things are suffering is because he's trying to help us not get too involved in this world with its potential of giving us suffering. That's why monks don't have wives. Yeah, and why nuns don't have that's why nuns don't have husbands. Because if we develop a strong attachment, then if that person dies, then we're going to suffer a lot. So the Buddha was very, like he knew what he was talking about, and he set up a life which minimized the amount of suffering that a monastic can have. Yeah? And, but as, as people just understand, like, you're not being a bad Buddhist because you can't let it go. And just understand that it's just human nature for one to suffer for long periods of time when something like this happens. But I think it gets to a point where you wake up one morning and you can say to yourself, I don't need to suffer anymore. And you're able to just move on in life. And Ajahn Brahm talks about the story about about two little kids playing on a jetty, and they were really good friends. And this little kid just pushed his friend off the jetty. The little boy fell into the water. I don't know what happened, couldn't swim, and drowned. So the boy who pushed his friend over the edge and killed him suffered for many years, even though the parents of the boy who died told him that, you know, it was an accident, it's not your fault, you can let it go, don't worry about it anymore, you've suffered enough. But because this kid felt such a great deal of guilt, he held it in his heart for many, many years. But he wanted to let it go, but he couldn't let it go. That's the thing. Sometimes we want to let these sufferings go away, but there's something within us that's stopping us from doing that. And I don't know why. Maybe it's just the mind processing things. And then eventually when it's ready, the mind will let it go. And the same thing happened for this kid. He was carrying this guilt for many, many years. And then he just woke up one day and he told himself that he didn't have to put himself through this suffering anymore. So when he had that insight, he was able to let go and then move on with life. Yeah, and like, you know, I say, people say happy, happy, happy wife, happy life. Yeah, that's the saying, right? Monks say no wife, happy life. All right. Next, yes. Gratefulness.
You're suffering, but it's hard to let go. So would you?
Yeah. That's a good point, actually. Gratefulness, you can sort of like see it as a teaching. Yeah, it's teaching you something, so that gives you. It's just like what it is. It's just a different perception on the problem that you have that eases the pain. Yeah, and then eventually these things will disappear. Yeah, because sometimes you just get caught up in it, and you can become a bit negative, and that's just adding like more negativity onto the problem. So like having like a sense of like gratefulness, you're learning a lesson about life and about the Dhamma. That sort of takes the sharpness away from whatever you're going through, and just numbing it a little bit, but it doesn't get rid of the pain and suffering. Yeah, and it does. It's actually quite helpful, because sometimes, you know, you get caught up and you just need a different perception on something, and that just it's like gives you a relief. It's sort of like you're suffering from pain, you take a Panadol, and it feels a little bit better. And it's sort of like with developing like the right perceptions towards certain things that happen in our lives. Yeah, it's like perceptions colour our world. And it's just like just growing up with monks, and you see monks who have trained and developed their mind in using positive perceptions. And these monks are beautiful monks, you know, because they're able to do that. Just being able to just look at the brighter side of life. Yeah. Just being, even though he's just being a little bit more positive. Mm. And it's sort of like, you know, you may not think that it works now, but I think if you just have a little bit of a faith and just continue on, then you can start to see that these things actually have some sort of benefit. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Please, can you teach a 5-day retreat? Is that a bit too long? It's probably a bit too long for me. I've run out of things to say. Yeah, why not? I'll give it a shot. Yeah. Why do we usually finish retreats with metta meditation? It might make a nice beginning to a retreat. Yes. I think, I don't know why. It's just Ajahn's been doing it for a long, long time. Finishing off the retreat with a metta meditation. But, yeah, it doesn't... Just to spread all... I think because you've accumulated all this like energy meditating here. You stored it up, and at the end you can like share with other people. I think that's one of the reasons why they do that. But actually, the metta meditation is more of a like a soft, like emotional kind of like, you know, feely-feely kind of meditation. And if you get into it, you're just basically like sharing that good energy with other people. Yeah. At the monastery, do the monks often meditate together or mostly alone in their kutis? So in the monastery that we are living in, Jayako lives in Serpentine, I live in Kelmscott. Come visit me, please. And we just meditate alone. Yeah, for the most part. Yeah. And it's kind of nice actually to come and meditate with other people. Yeah. You just sit together and you sit for a bit longer and you just watch the mind. Yeah. And the beautiful thing, you watch the mind grow over time. And it's sort of, yeah. Any questions? Comments? No? Anybody sleepy? No? Okay. Okay, so, I got 10 more minutes. So, why did I become a monk? Well, this is going to take like half an hour to answer. Common question. I think we get asked, the monks get asked this at every retreat. Yeah. And yeah, it's, I think what if I become a monk is because my mother kicked me out of my house, I had nowhere to go. No, she didn't kick me out. Sorry, Mum. Why do I become a monk? Okay. Reason... I don't know. I do know and I don't know. It's kind of weird, yeah? Sometimes you try to figure these things out. What were the causes to propel me to become a monk? And I think... it's partly because of the suffering that we experience as human beings, young teenagers, young adults. I had those sufferings, and I just wanted to figure it out and do something to help myself, right? And I didn't want to see a psychologist. I didn't want to get any external help from anybody. And I thought, if, I don't know how, but if the Buddha did it himself, then maybe I could do it myself. So I got attracted to the meditation practice. Yeah. And that sort of makes sense to me, being able to just sit down quietly and allow the meditation to sort of like fix the problems that you had or you have within your own mind. And yeah, you know, I had, and yeah, and then how I got a connection towards Buddhism, I think it's because of my upbringing, coming from like Asian family, we're migrants from Vietnam, and I was like, I sort of joked that, you know, our family, we escaped Vietnam, and we're on the boat, and my mom was pregnant with me on the boat, so I had the most comfortable seat on the way from Vietnam to Indonesia. So then my mom went to Vietnam, had me, and then I moved to Australia. So when they brought their culture and their understanding of religion with them, and for me, growing up, it was going to these like Mahayana temples that you see in Perth. Like you get the place on Money Street, and you have another place just behind William Street. I forgot the name of the street, and we would go there every year to light joysticks and pray for good grades, a good car, and a lot of money. I never got any of those, so I lost all faith. I lost all faith in praying to something to somebody for something. So as I grew up, I was very skeptical in all these rites and rituals, because when I was younger, my mum would make me do it, and she would actually tell me what to say, but it never worked out. So in that sense, I bring that type of like Western thinking to the way I look at life, because I grew up in Australia. I'm very Aussie, but at the same time, I think what has transferred through just growing up with an Asian family is that like respect that you have for your elders, and that closeness that you have with family. Yeah, so families are like very important to us. I think that's one of my connections why I turned to Buddhism. At the stage of my life where I thought that I wanted to do some sort of meditation or something. For some reason, my mind just, maybe going to bookstores and you read a little bit about Buddhism. Because it was at the time where there was no internet, right? So everything was like word of mouth at that time, pretty much word of mouth when it came to Buddhism in WA. So my mum knew what my wishes were, and she was trying to help me out. So I even had the intentions to actually go to Vietnam to ordain as a monk, because my mum knew of a meditation teacher at the time. But that didn't work out. I don't know why. But then my mum had another friend who knew about Bodhinyana Monastery, yeah? And I remember I remember driving up to the monastery on one of the big ceremony days. I remember it was really hot, and we're sitting in the Dhamma hall, and I didn't really want to be there, but I was there. So that was my first encounter with Bodhinyana Monastery. I didn't even know who Ajahn Brahm was at the time. And this was at the time where he wasn't as famous as he is now, but his fame was slowly growing. He was starting to travel interstate and overseas. But I think this was the time when it was a couple of years before that. But when I got into the monastery, that was the time when he finished his six-month retreat. This was ages ago. What? 2002. Yeah, ages ago. And I didn't even know who Ajahn Brahm was. All I wanted was a place to go and meditate, right? And, So I remember this Vietnamese lady, I'm very grateful for her because she introduced me to Bodhinyana Monastery. And she is still now, to this day, is a very strong supporter of the monks and nuns. And she took me up to Ajahn Bhamali. Actually, I remember talking to Ajahn Bhamali and I told him, oh yeah, I want to be a monk. And you know what he did? He took out his notebook. I think he took out his notebook and wrote down my name and I wanted to become a monk. And then he said, oh, you got to write a letter, blah, 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 blah. So then I went through all the right channels, I wrote a letter. And then I found myself in Bodhinyana Monastery. Yeah, so the reason why I became a monk is quite simple. I just wanted to learn how to meditate. I wasn't there for, of course, and also wanting to become enlightened. That was another reason. Yeah, and I think that's the main reason why people meditate, why people become monks as well. And I think one of the reasons why I decided to do that is because of just having an understanding that we have certain like types of suffering that we have as young people growing up in a Western society. So I was having a few troubles in life, and I was trying to find a way to overcome it. And for some reason, my mind turned towards Buddhism and meditation. And at the very beginning, I think I meditated for 2 years at home before I decided to take that leap to join a monastery. And just like you guys, when I first started, it was very difficult. I would sit down and everything would just become hot because like the mind was racing. I couldn't sit down for long. Half an hour felt like 2 hours. It was like being in high school again. Okay. It's like being in high school again. Yeah. All right. And then, so I was like just going through all these trials and tribulations that beginner meditators have. But the one thing I got from it is afterwards, I felt good. Yeah? Afterwards, I felt some sort of benefit. Like my mind had a chance to rest, even though it was restless. But in between those moments of restlessness, even though I couldn't see it at the time because the mind didn't have enough mindfulness, the mind was actually, I think, resting. And also the body was able to rest as well. And even though I wasn't like watching my breath or getting the jhanas or nimittas, but afterwards I felt good. And sort of I knew that it's not all like the meditation is not like, it's not all that, it's difficult, but it's not all that bad to like keep me away from it for good. So I saw some sort of benefit in it and I just kept on doing it at home. Yeah, so I did all the, you know, the Buddhist thing, you know, buy myself a Buddhist statue, go to the BSWA, go use the library, buy myself a meditation cushion and things like that. A really eager Buddhist. But it was all worth it. And whenever I had free time, I just try to meditate and do walking meditation at home. And I actually took, I remember taking a year off from work to actually look deeper at my intentions to see whether I wanted to join the monastery or not. And then I spent that year just working part-time, but also at the same time just dedicating myself to learning a little bit about Buddhism and also meditation. And then I got to the point where I thought, okay, I'll just give it a go. So I was only 23 years old. Yeah. And I remember that day when my mum dropped me off. It was a hot, huh?
I remember.
Yeah.
Say to me, Mom, you give me 1 year and I go be the mom. And I say, you're joking.
Oh, yeah, see, I cut a deal with my mom. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I let my mum know. Like in a year's time, I go and become a monk. And she just laughed. No, she didn't laugh. So I went in, joined the monastery. And and the reason why I still stay as a monk is because I can see like progress happening in my meditation practice. Yeah, it's just that simple. You know, it's just simple for me. It's like I don't. Because that's the main reason why you become a monk, is to be able to just meditate and try to develop the deep meditations, and then have the insight, so you can actually liberate yourself from the world of samsara. Yeah, become one of the enlightened beings. I guess each and every one of us has that. Each and every one of us monks have that, you know, intention. And I'm happy. That's the main thing. I'm happy. Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever felt regret, or that you want to quit and go back to your
life? Oh, many times. Many times. Yeah, many times. I remember, like, I was Anagarika, and I was having a lot of fun in the kitchen, because I was doing my apprenticeship as a chef, so then I stopped doing that, and then I decided, okay, I'm in the monastery, and there's a kitchen, and there's heaps of food. So I started cooking heaps of food for the monks to eat. And I was having a good time and developing some sort of like attachment to being an anagarika. So when I became a monk or a novice, I got a little bit depressed. It's kind of weird, you know, you become attached to something, and then once you don't have it, and then the mind starts becoming a little bit sad. And then it becomes a little bit sad, and then it starts thinking about it. And then it adds a story onto something that really isn't there. So that's what was happening to me. It's sort of like I allowed my mind to sort of spin out of control. Yeah. And that happens a few times, obviously. I'm not lying. It's not like you become a monk and then, because you're living with Ajahn Brahman and other senior monks, that your life is going to be easy. I don't know. That's why monks disrobe, yeah? It's because it's not easy. And if you think about it, right? I just was just thinking about it today, and it was kind of a little bit depressing. It's like, the monks, we spend a lot of time by ourselves. Yeah. That's the way. Ajahn Brahm tortures us. He tortures us. You have to work in the morning. After the meal, you go back to your hut. And we don't see you ever again. Being alone, for some people, especially for myself in the earlier days, can be very difficult. Yeah. Because you're like, hardly any distractions, or if you do have any distractions, it's just only a few of them. It's not like you can get in your car and just go see a mate, or things like that. You don't have that freedom anymore. And just doing the same thing every day. Can you imagine that? For like 15 years, same thing. Pretty much every day. Go back to your hut. Huh? Go back to your hut at 12 o'clock. Doing the same thing. You know, if you're not careful, you go crazy. Or you suffer a lot. Yeah, that's why some monks don't last. So I was thinking, you know, for me, it's like, you know, I've learned how to deal with like seclusion and living alone. But sometimes when you think about these younger monks, and they still don't get it, or they still don't know how to manage their time or what they expose their minds to when they're in their rooms, And because of that, they're stuck and they're suffering a lot over it. And because you're living in seclusion, you can't really escape it. So you're facing it every day. And I think that's the sadness of living a monastic life, which you are put into seclusion, is if you don't know how to deal with it, then it can create quite a bit of suffering for the person. Yeah. I think that's the reality of it, yeah. So, do you want to become a monk now or a nun? I could be wrong. I could be wrong. Okay, any more questions, comments? No? Okay. We can finish now.